me. Do what will make you the happiest. However, I beg you to give me a second chance, to have the courage to leave this place and shed the bitter memories of our life here. We can start anew in Sörde. She was quiet for a long time. That young man who was here, is he really a rider? He is. The winds of change are blowing, Helen. The Varden are about to attack, the dwarves are gathering, and even the elves stir in their ancient haunts. War approaches, and if we are fortunate, so does Galbatorix's downfall. Are you important among the Varden? They owe me some consideration for my part in acquiring Saphira's egg. Then you would have a position with them in Sörde? I imagine so. He put his hands on her shoulders, and she did not draw away. She whispered, Jode, Jode, don't press me. I cannot decide yet. Will you think about it? She shivered. Oh, yes. I'll think about it. Roran's heart pained him as he left. Katrina. That night at dinner, Roran noticed Helen's eyes were often upon him, studying and measuring, comparing him, he was sure, to Aragorn. After the meal, Roran beckoned to Mandel and led him out into the courtyard behind the house. What is it, sir? Asked Mandel. I wish to talk with you in private. About what? Roran fingered the pitted blade of his hammer and reflected on how much he felt like Garrow when his father gave a lecture on responsibility. Roran could even feel the same phrases rising in his throat. And so one generation passes to the next, he thought. You've become quite friendly with the sailors as of late. They're not our enemies, objected Mandel. Everyone is an enemy at this point. Clovis and his men could turn on us in an instant. It wouldn't be a problem, though, if being with them hadn't caused you to neglect your duties. Mandel stiffened and colour bloomed in his cheeks, but he did not lower himself in Roran's esteem by denying the charge. Pleased, Roran asked, What is the most important thing we can do right now, Mandel? Protect our families. Aye. And what else? Mandel hesitated, uncertain, then confessed, I don't know. Help one another. It's the only way any of us are going to survive. I was especially disappointed to learn that you've gambled food with the sailors, since that endangers the entire village. Your time would be far better spent hunting than playing games of dice or learning to throw knives. With your father gone, it's fallen upon you to care for your mother and siblings. They rely on you. Am I clear?
Very clear, sir,
replied Mandel with a choked voice. Will this ever happen again?
Never again, sir.
Good. Now, I didn't bring you here just to chastise you. You show promise, which is why I'm giving you a task that I would trust to no one else but myself.
Yes, sir.
Tomorrow morning, I need you to return to camp and deliver a message to Horst. Jode believes the Empire has spies watching this house, so it's vital that you make sure you aren't followed. Wait until you're out of the city, then lose whoever is trailing you in the countryside. Kill him if you have to. When you find Horst, tell him to... As Roran outlined his instructions, he watched Mandel's expression change from surprise to shock, and then to awe.
What if Clovis objects? Asked Mandel.
That night, break the tillers on the barges so they can't be steered. It's a dirty trick, but it could be disastrous if Clovis or any of his men arrive at Tirm before you.
I won't let that happen, vowed Mandel.
Roran smiled. Good. Satisfied that he had resolved the matter of Mandel's behaviour and that the young man would do everything possible to get the message to Horst, Roran went back inside and bade their host good night before heading off to sleep. With the exception of Mandel, Roran and his companions confined themselves to the mansion throughout the following day, taking advantage of the delay to rest, hone their weapons, and review their stratagems. From dawn till dusk, they saw some of Helen as she bustled from one room to the next, more of Rolf with his teeth like varnished pearls, and none of Jode, for the grey-pated merchant had left to walk the city and, seemingly by accident, meet with the few men of the sea whom he trusted for their expedition. Upon his return he told Roran, "We can count on 5 more hands. I only hope it's enough." Jod remained in his study for the rest of the evening, drawing up various legal documents and otherwise tending to his affairs. 3 hours before dawn, Roran, Loring, Birgit, Gertrude and Nolfarel roused themselves and, fighting back prodigious yawns, congregated in the mansion's entryway, where they muffled themselves in long cloaks to obscure their faces. A rapier hung at Jode's side when he joined them, and Roran thought the narrow sword somehow completed the rangy man, as if it reminded Jode who he really was. Jode lit an oil lantern and held it up before them. "Are we ready?" he asked. They nodded. Then Jode unlatched the door and they filed outside to the empty cobblestone street. Behind them, Jode lingered in the entryway, casting a longing gaze toward the stairs on the right. But Helen did not appear. With a shudder, Jode left his home and closed the door. Roran put a hand on his arm. "What's done is done."
"I know."
They trotted through the dark city, slowing to a quick walk whenever they encountered watchmen or a fellow creature of the night, most of whom darted away at the sight of them. Once they heard footsteps on top of a nearby building.
"The design of the city," explained Jode, "makes it easy for thieves to climb from one roof to another."
They slowed to a walk again when they arrived at Tiam's eastern gate. Because the gate opened to the harbour, it was closed only 4 hours each night in order to minimise the disruption to commerce. Indeed, despite the time, several men were already moving through the gate. Even though Jode had warned them it might happen, Roran still felt a surge of fear when the guards lowered their pikes and asked what their business was. He wet his mouth and tried not to fidget while the elder soldier examined a scroll that Jode handed to him. After a long minute, the guard nodded and returned the parchment.
"You can pass."
Once they were on the wharf and out of earshot of the city wall, Jode said,
"It's a good thing he couldn't read."
The 6 of them waited on the damp planking until one by one Jode's men emerged from the grey mist that lay upon the shore. They were grim and silent, with braided hair that hung to the middle of their backs, tar-smeared hands, and an assortment of scars even Roran respected. He liked what he saw, and he could tell they approved of him as well. They did not, however, take to Birgit. One of the sailors, a large brute of a man, jerked a thumb at her and accused Jode.
"You didn't say there'd be a woman along for the fighting. How am I supposed to concentrate with some backwoods tramp getting him away?"
"Don't talk about her like that," said Nolfarel between clenched teeth.
"And a runt too?"
In a calm voice, Jode said,
"Birgit has fought the Razak, and her son has already killed one of Galbatorix's best soldiers. Can you claim as much, Uthar?"
"It's not proper," said another man. "I wouldn't feel safe with a woman at my side. They do naught but bring bad luck. A lady shouldn't—"
Whatever he was going to say was lost, for at that instant Birgit did a very unladylike thing. Stepping forward, she kicked Uthar between his legs and then grabbed the second man and pressed her knife against his throat. She held him for a moment so everyone could see what she had done, then released her captive. Uthar rolled on the boards by her feet, holding himself and muttering a stream of curses.
"Does anyone else have an objection?" demanded Birgit.
Beside her, Nolfarel stared with open-mouthed amazement at his mother. Roran pulled his hood lower to conceal his grin. "Good thing they haven't noticed Gertrude," he thought. When no one else challenged Birgit, Jode asked,
"Did you bring what I wanted?"
Each sailor reached inside his vest and divulged a weighted club and several lengths of rope. Thus armed, they worked their way down the harbour toward the Dragon Wing, doing their best to escape detection. Jode kept his lantern shuttered the whole while. Near the dock, they hid behind a warehouse and watched the 2 lights carried by sentries bob around the deck of the ship. The gangway had been pulled away for the night.
"Remember," whispered Jode,
The most important thing is to keep the alarm from being sounded until we're ready to leave.
Two men above, two men below, right?
Asked Roran. Uthar replied, That be the custom. Roran and Uthar stripped to their breeches, tied the rope and clubs around their waists. Roran left his hammer behind, and then ran farther down the wharf out of the sentry's sight, where they lowered themselves into the frigid water.
Oh, I hate when I have to do this, said Uthar.
You've done it before?
Four times now. Don't stop moving or you'll freeze.
Clinging to the slimy piles underneath the wharf, they swam back up the way they had come until they reached the stone pier that led to the dragon wing, and then turned right. Uthar put his lips to Roran's ear.
I'll take the starboard anchor.
Roran nodded his agreement. They both dove under the black water, and there they separated. Uthar swam like a frog under the bow of the ship, while Roran went straight to the port anchor and clung to its thick chain. He untied the club from his waist and fit it between his teeth, as much to stop them from chattering as to free his hands, and prepared to wait. The rough metal sapped the warmth from his arms as fast as ice. Not 3 minutes later, Roran heard the scuff of Birgit's boots above him as she walked to the end of the pier opposite the middle of the dragon wing, and then the faint sound of her voice as she engaged the sentries in conversation. Hopefully she would keep their attention away from the bow.
Now!
Roran pulled himself hand over hand along the chain. His right shoulder burned where the Razak had bit him, but he pressed on. From the porthole where the anchor chain entered the ship, he clambered up the ridges that supported the painted figurehead, over the railing, and onto the deck. Uthar was already there, dripping and panting. Clubs in hand, they padded toward the aft of the ship, using whatever cover they could find. They stopped not 10 feet behind the sentries. The two men leaned on the rail, bandying words with Birgit. In a flash, Roran and Uthar burst into the open and struck the sentries on the head before they could draw their sabres. Below, Birgit waved for Jod and the rest of their group, and between them they raised the gangway and slid one end across to the ship, where Uthar lashed it to the railing. As Nolfavrel ran aboard, Roran tossed his rope to the boy and said, "Tie and gag these two." Then everyone but Gertrude descended below decks to hunt for the remaining sentries. They found 4 additional men, the purser, the boatswain, the ship's cook, and the ship's cook's assistant, all of whom were trundled out of bed, knocked on the head if they resisted, and then securely trussed. In this, Birgit again proved her worth, capturing 2 men herself. Jod had the unhappy prisoners placed in a line on the deck, so they could be watched at all times, then declared, "We have much to do and little time. Roran, Uthar is captain on the dragon wing. You and the others will take your orders from him." For the next 2 hours the ship was a frenzy of activity. The sailors tended to the rigging and sails, while Roran and those from Carvajal worked to empty the hold of extraneous supplies, such as bales of raw wool. These they lowered overboard to prevent anyone on the wharf from hearing a splash. If the entire village was to fit on the dragon wing, they needed to clear as much space as possible. Roran was in the midst of fitting a cable around a barrel when he heard the hoarse cry, "Someone's coming!" Everyone on deck except Jod and Uthar dropped to their bellies and reached for their weapons. The 2 men who remained standing paced the ship as if they were sentries. Roran's heart pounded while he lay motionless, wondering what was about to happen. He held his breath as Jod addressed the intruder. Then footsteps echoed on the gangway. It was Helen. She wore a plain dress, her hair was bound under a kerchief, and she carried a burlap sack over one shoulder. She spoke not a word, but stowed her gear in the main cabin and returned to stand by Jod. Roran thought he had never seen a happier man. The sky above the distant mountains of the spine had just begun to brighten when one of the sailors in the rigging pointed north and whistled to indicate he had spotted the villagers. Roran moved even faster. What time they had was now gone. He rushed up on deck and peered at the dark line of people advancing down the coast. This part of their plan depended on the fact that, unlike other coastal cities, Tirm's outer wall had not been left open to the sea, but rather completely enclosed the bulk of the city in order to ward off frequent pirate attacks. This meant that the buildings skirting the harbour were left exposed, and that the villagers could walk right up to the Dragon Wing.
"Hurry now, hurry!"
said Jode. At Uthar's command, the sailors brought out armfuls of javelins for the great bows on deck, as well as casks of foul-smelling tar, which they knocked open and used to paint the upper half of the javelins. Then they drew and loaded the ballistae on the starboard side. It took 2 men per bow to pull out the sinew cord until it caught on its hook. The villagers were 2/3 of the way to the ship before the soldiers patrolling the battlements of Tirm spotted them and trumpeted the alarm. Even before that first note faded, Uthar bellowed, "Light and fire 'em!" Dashing open Jode's lantern, Nolfrevel ran from one ballista to the next, holding the flame to the javelins until the tar ignited. The instant a missile caught, the man behind the bow pulled the release line, and the javelin vanished with a heavy thunk. In all, 12 blazing bolts shot from the Dragon Wing and pierced the ships and buildings along the bay like roaring red-hot meteors from the heavens above.
"Draw and reload!" shouted Uthar.
The creak of bending wood filled the air as every man hauled back on the twisted cords. Javelins were slotted in place. Once again, Nolfrevel made his run. Roran could feel the vibration in his feet as the ballista in front of him sent its deadly projectile winging on its way. The fire quickly spread along the waterfront, forming an impenetrable barrier that prevented soldiers from reaching the Dragon Wing through Tiam's east gate. Roran had counted on the pillar of smoke to hide the ship from the archers on the battlements, but it was a near thing. A flight of arrows tugged at the rigging, and one dart embedded itself in the deck by Gertrude before the soldiers lost sight of the ship. From the bow, Uthar shouted,
"Pick your targets at will!"
The villagers were running pell-mell down the beach now. They reached the north end of the wharf, and a handful of them stumbled and fell as the soldiers in Tirm redirected their aim. Children screamed in terror. Then the villagers regained momentum. They pounded down the planks, past a warehouse engulfed in flame, and along the pier. The panting mob charged onto the ship in a confused mass of jostling bodies. Birgit and Gertrude guided the stream of people to the fore and aft hatches. In a few minutes, the various levels of the ship were packed to their limit, from the cargo hold to the captain's cabin. Those who could not fit below remained huddled on deck, holding Fisk's shields over their heads. As Roran had asked in his message, all able-bodied men from Carvajal clustered around the mainmast, waiting for instructions. Roran saw Mandel among them and tossed him a proud salute. Then Uthar pointed at a sailor and barked,
"You there, Bonden! Get those swabs to the capstans and weigh anchors, then down to the oars. Double time!"
To the rest of the men at the ballista, he ordered,
"Half of you leave off and take the port ballista. Drive away any boarding parties."
Roran was one of those who switched sides. As he prepared the ballista, a few laggards staggered out of the acrid smoke and onto the ship. Beside him, Jode and Helen hoisted the 6 prisoners one by one onto the gangway and rolled them onto the pier. Before Roran quite knew it, anchors had been raised, the gangway was cut loose, and a drum pounded beneath his feet, setting the tempo for the oarsmen. Ever so slowly, the Dragon Wing turned to starboard, toward the open sea, and then, with gathering speed, pulled away from the dock. Roran accompanied Jode to the quarterdeck, where they watched the crimson inferno devour everything flammable between Tirm and the ocean. Through the filter of smoke, the sun appeared a flat, bloated, bloody orange disk as it rose over the city.
"How many have I killed now?" wondered Roran.
Echoing his thoughts, Jode observed,
"This will harm a great many innocent people."
Guilt made Roran respond with more force than he intended. "Would you rather be in Lord Ristart's prisons? I doubt many will be injured in the blaze, and those that aren't won't face death like we will if the Empire catches us."
"You needn't lecture me, Roran. I know the arguments well enough. We did what we had to. Just don't ask me to take pleasure in the suffering we've caused to ensure our own safety."
By noon, the oars had been stowed and the Dragon Wing sailed under her own power, propelled by favourable winds from the north. The gusts of air caused the rigging overhead to emit a low hum. The ship was miserably overcrowded, but Roran was confident that with some careful planning they could make it to Surda with a minimum of discomfort. The worst inconvenience was that of limited rations. If they were to avoid starvation, food would have to be dispensed in miserly portions. And in such cramped quarters, disease was an all too likely possibility. After Uthar gave a brief speech about the importance of discipline on a ship, the villagers applied themselves to the tasks that required their immediate attention, such as tending to their wounded, unpacking their meagre belongings, and deciding upon the most efficient sleeping arrangement for each deck. They also had to choose people to fill the various positions on the Dragon Wing, who would cook, who would train as sailors under Uthar's men, and so forth. Roran was helping Elaine hang a hammock when he became embroiled in a heated dispute between Odile, her family, and Freewin, who had apparently deserted Torsen's crew to stay with Odile. The two of them wanted to marry, which Odile's parents vehemently opposed on the grounds that the young sailor lacked a family of his own, a respectable profession, and the means to provide even a modicum of comfort for their daughter. Roran thought it best if the enamoured couple remained together. It seemed impractical to try and separate them while they remained confined to the same ship, but Odile's parents refused to give his arguments credence. Frustrated, Roran said, "What would you do, then? You can't lock her away, and I believe Freewin has proved his devotion more than..." "Razak!" The cry came from the crow's nest. Without a second thought, Roran yanked his hammer from his belt, whirled about, and scrambled up the ladder through the fore hatchway, barking his shin on the way. He sprinted toward the knot of people on the quarterdeck, coming to a halt beside Horst. The smith pointed. One of the Razak's dread steeds drifted like a tattered shadow above the edge of the coastline, a Razak on its back. Seeing the two monsters exposed in daylight in no way diminished the creeping horror they inspired in Roran. He shuddered as the winged creature uttered its terrifying shriek, and then the Razak's insectile voice drifted across the water, faint but distinct.
"You shall not escape!"
Roran looked at the ballistae, but they could not turn far enough to aim at the Razak or its mount.
"Does anyone have a bow?"
"I do," said Baldur. He dropped to one knee and began to string his weapon.
"Don't let them see me."
Everyone on the quarterdeck gathered in a tight circle around Baldur, shielding him with their bodies from the Razak's malevolent gaze.
"Why don't they attack?" growled Horst.
Puzzled, Roran reached for an explanation, but found none. It was Jode who suggested,
"Perhaps it's too bright for them. The Razak hunt at night, and so far as I know, they do not willingly venture forth from their lairs while the sun is yet in the sky."
"It's not just that," said Gertrude slowly. "I think they're afraid of the ocean."
"Afraid of the ocean?" scoffed Horst.
"Watch them. They don't fly more than a yard over the water at any given time."
"She's right," said Roran. "At last, a weakness I can use against them."
A few seconds later, Baldur said,
"Ready."
At his word, the ranks of people who stood before him jumped aside, clearing the path for his arrow. Baldur sprang to his feet, and in a single motion pulled the feather to his cheek and loosed the reed shaft. It was a heroic shot. The Razak was at the extreme edge of the longbow's range, far beyond any mark Roran had seen an archer hit, and yet Baldur's aim was true. His arrow struck the flying creature on the right flank, and the beast gave a scream of pain so great that the glass on the deck was shattered, and the stones on the shore were riven in shards. Roran clapped his hands over his ears to protect them from the hideous blast. Still screaming, the monster veered inland and dropped behind a line of misty hills.
"Did you kill it?"
asked Jode, his face pale.
"I fear not," replied Baldur. "It was naught but a flesh wound."
Loring, who had just arrived, observed with satisfaction,
"Aye, but at least you hurt him, and I'd wager they'll think twice about bothering us again."
Gloom settled over Roran.
"Save your triumph for later, Loring. This was no victory."
"Why not?" demanded Horst.
because now the Empire knows exactly where we are." The quarterdeck fell silent as they grasped the implications of what he had said.
Child's play. "And this," said Triana, "is the latest pattern we've invented." Nasuada took the black veil from the sorceress and ran it through her hands, marvelling at its quality. No human could throw lace that fine. She gazed with satisfaction at the rows of boxes on her desk, which contained samples of the many designs Duvrangar Gata now produced.
"You've done well," she said, "far better than I had hoped. Tell your spellcasters how pleased I am with their work. It means much to the Varden."
Triana inclined her head at the praise. "I will convey your message to them, Lady Nasuada."
"Have they yet—"
A disturbance at the doors to her quarters interrupted Nasuada. She heard her guards swear and raise their voices, then a yelp of pain. The sound of metal clashing on metal rang in the hallway. Nasuada backed away from the door in alarm, drawing her dagger from its sheath.
"Run, lady," said Triana.
The sorceress placed herself in front of Nasuada and pushed back her sleeves, baring her white arms in preparation to work magic.
"Take the servant's entrance."
Before Nasuada could move, the doors burst open and a small figure tackled her legs, knocking her to the floor. Even as Nasuada fell, a silvery object flashed through the space she had just occupied, burying itself in the far wall with a dull thud. Then the four guards entered, and all was confusion, as Nasuada felt them drag her assailant off her. When Nasuada managed to stand, she saw Elva hanging in their grip.
"What is the meaning of this?" demanded Nasuada.
The black-haired girl smiled, then doubled over and retched on the braided rug. Afterward, she fixed her violet eyes on Nasuada, and in her terrible, knowing voice, she said,
"Have your magician examine the wall, O daughter of Ajihad, and see if I have not fulfilled my promise to you."
Nasuada nodded to Triana, who glided to the splintered hole in the wall and muttered a spell. She returned, holding a metal dart.
"This was buried in the wood."
"But where did it come from?"
asked Nasuada, bewildered. Triana gestured toward the open window overlooking the city of Aberon.
"Somewhere out there, I guess."
Nasuada returned her attention to the waiting child.
"What do you know about this, Elva?"
The girl's horrible smile widened.
"It was an assassin."
"Who sent him?"
"An assassin trained by Galbatorix himself in the dark uses of magic."
Her burning eyes grew half-lidded, as if she were in a trance.
"The man hates you. He's coming for you. He would have killed you if I hadn't stopped him."
She lurched forward and retched again, spewing half-digested food across the floor.
Nasuada gagged with revulsion.
"And he's about to suffer great pain."
"Why is that?"
"Because I will tell you, he stays in the hostel on Fane Street, in the last room on the top floor. You had better hurry, or he'll get away, away."
She groaned like a wounded beast and clutched her belly.
"Hurry, before Aragorn's spell forces me to stop you from hurting him. You'll be sorry then."
Triana was already moving, as Nasuada said, "Tell Jormunda what's happened. Then take your strongest magicians and hunt down this man. Capture him if you can. Kill him if you can't." After the sorceress left, Nasuada looked at her men and saw that their legs were bleeding from numerous small cuts. She realized what it must have cost Elva to hurt them.
"Go," she told them. "Find a healer who can mend your injuries."
The warriors shook their heads and their captain said, "No, ma'am. We will stay by your side until we know it's safe again."
"As you see fit, captain."
The men barricaded the windows, which worsened the already sweltering heat that plagued Borromeo Castle. Then everyone retreated to her inner chambers for further protection. Nasuada paced, her heart pounding with delayed shock as she contemplated how close she had come to being killed.
"What would become of the Varden if I died?" she wondered. "Who would succeed me?"
Dismay gripped her.
She had made no arrangements for the Varden in the event of her own demise, an oversight that now seemed a monumental failing. I won't allow the Varden to be thrown into chaos because I failed to take precautions. She halted. I am in your debt, Elva.
Now and forever.
Nasuada faltered, disconcerted as she often was by the girl's responses, then continued. I apologize for not ordering my guards to let you pass night or day. I should have anticipated an event like this.
You should have, agreed Elva in a mocking tone.
Smoothing the front of her dress, Nasuada resumed pacing, as much to escape the sight of Elva's stone-white, dragon-marked face as to disperse her own nervous energy. How did you escape your rooms unaccompanied?
I told my caretaker, Greta, what she wanted to hear.
That's all? Elva blinked.
It made her very happy.
And what of Angela?
She left on an errand this morning.
Well, be as that may, you have my gratitude for saving my life. Ask me any boon you want, and I shall grant it if it's within my power. Elva glanced around the ornate bedroom, then said,
Do you have any food? I'm hungry.
Premonition of War. 2 hours later, Triana returned, leading a pair of warriors who carried a limp body between them. At Triana's word, the men dropped the corpse on the floor. Then the sorceress said,
We found the assassin where Elva said we would. Drail was his name.
Motivated by a morbid curiosity, Nasuada examined the face of the man who had tried to kill her. The assassin was short, bearded and plain-looking, no different from countless other men in the city. She felt a certain connection to him, as if his attempt on her life and the fact that she had arranged his death in return linked them in the most intimate manner possible. How was he killed? She asked. I see no marks on his body.
He committed suicide with magic when we overwhelmed his defences and entered his mind, but before we could take control of his actions.
Were you able to learn anything of use before he died?
We were. Drail was part of a network of agents based here in Surda who are loyal to Galbatorix. They are called the Black Hand. They spy on us, sabotage our war efforts, and, best we could determine in our brief glimpse into Drail's memories, are responsible for dozens of murders throughout the Varden. Apparently, they've been waiting for a good chance to kill you ever since we arrived from Farthan Dûr.
Why hasn't this Black Hand assassinated King Orin yet?
Triana shrugged.
I can't say. It may be that Galbatorix considers you to be more of a threat than Orin. If that's the case, then once the Black Hand realizes you are protected from their attacks...
Here her gaze darted toward Elva.
Orin won't live another month unless he is guarded by magicians day and night. Or perhaps Galbatorix has abstained from such direct action because he wanted the Black Hand to remain unnoticed. Surda has always existed at his tolerance. Now that it's become a threat.
Can you protect Orin as well? Asked Nasuada, turning to Elva.
Her violet eyes seemed to glow.
Maybe, if he asks nicely.
Nasuada's thoughts raced as she considered how to thwart this new menace.
Can all of Galbatorix's agents use magic?
Drail's mind was confused, so it's hard to tell, said Triana. But I'd guess a fair number of them can.
Magic,
cursed Nasuada to herself. The greatest danger the Varden faced from magicians, or any person trained in the use of their mind, was not assassination, but rather espionage. Magicians could spy on people's thoughts and glean information that could be used to destroy the Varden. That was precisely why Nasuada and the entire command structure of the Varden had been taught to know when someone was touching their minds and how to shield themselves from such attentions. Nasuada suspected that Orin and Hrothgar relied upon similar precautions within their own governments. However, since it was impractical for everyone privy to potentially damaging information to master that skill,
One of Duvrangar Gata's many responsibilities was to hunt for anyone who was siphoning off facts as they appeared in people's minds. The cost of such vigilance was that Duvrangar Gata ended up spying on the Vardhan as much as on their enemies, a fact that Nasawada made sure to conceal from the bulk of her followers, for it would only sow hatred, distrust, and dissent. She disliked the practice, but saw no alternative. What she had learned about the Black Hand hardened Nasawada's conviction that somehow magicians had to be governed.
"Why," she asked, "didn't you discover this sooner? I can understand that you might miss a lone assassin, but an entire network of spellcasters dedicated to our destruction? Explain yourself, Triana."
The sorceress's eyes flashed with anger at the accusation.
"Because here, unlike in Farthan Dur, we cannot examine everyone's mind for duplicity. There are just too many people for us magicians to keep track of. That is why we didn't know about the Black Hand until now, Lady Nasawada."
Nasawada paused, then inclined her head.
"Understood. Did you discover the identities of any other members of the Black Hand?"
"A few."
"Good. Use them to ferret out the rest of the agents. I want you to destroy this organization for me, Triana. Eradicate them as you would an infestation of vermin. I'll give you however many men you need."
The sorceress bowed.
"As you wish, Lady Nasawada."
At a knock on the door, the guards drew their swords and positioned themselves on either side of the entranceway. Then their captain yanked open the door without warning. A young page stood outside, a fist raised to knock again. He stared with astonishment at the body on the floor, then snapped to attention as the captain asked,
"What is it, boy?"
"I have a message for Lady Nasawada from King Orin."
"Then speak, and be quick about it," said Nasawada.
The page took a moment to compose himself.
"King Orin requests that you attend him directly in his council chambers, for he has received reports from the Empire that demand your immediate attention."
"Is that all?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"I must attend to this. Triana, you have your orders. Captain, will you leave one of your men to dispose of Drail?"
"Aye, ma'am."
"Also, please have him locate Farrakha, my handmaid. She will see to it that my study is cleaned."
"And what of me?"
asked Elva, tilting her head.
"You," said Nasawada, "shall accompany me. That is, if you feel strong enough to do so."
The girl threw back her head, and from her small, round mouth emanated a cold laugh.
"I'm strong enough, Nasawada. Are you?"
Ignoring the question, Nasawada swept forth into the hallway with her guards clustered around her. The stones of the castle exuded an earthy smell in the heat. Behind her she heard the patter of Elva's footsteps, and was perversely pleased that the ghastly child had to hurry to keep pace with the adult's longer stride. The guards remained behind in the vestibule to the council chambers, while Nasawada and Elva proceeded inside. The chambers were bare to the point of severity, reflecting the militant nature of Surda's existence. The country's kings had devoted their resources to protecting their people and overthrowing Galbatorix, not to decorating Borromeo Castle with idle riches, as the dwarves had done with Trondheim. In the main room lay a rough-hewn table 12 feet long, upon which a map of Alagazia was staked open with daggers at the four corners. As was custom, Orin sat at the head of the table, while his various advisers, many of whom Nasawada knew vehemently opposed her, occupied the chairs farther down. The Council of Elders was also present. Nasawada noticed the concern on Jormunda's face as he looked at her, and deduced that Triana had indeed told him about Drail.
"Sire, you asked for me?"
Orin rose.
"That I did. We have now..."
He stopped in mid-word as he noticed Elva.
"Ah, yes, Shining Brow. I have not had the opportunity to grant you audience before, though accounts of your feats have reached my ear, and I must confess I have been most curious to meet you. Have you found the quarters I arranged for you satisfactory?"
"They are quite nice, sire. Thank you."
At the sound of her eerie voice, the voice of an adult, everyone at the table flinched. Erwin, the Prime Minister, bolted upright and pointed a quivering finger at Elva.
"Why have you brought this abomination here?"
"You forget your manners, sir," replied Nasawada, though she understood his sentiment.
Orin frowned.
"Yes, do restrain yourself, Erwin. However, his point is valid, Nasawada. We cannot have this child present at our deliberations.
The Empire, she said, has just tried to assassinate me. The room echoed with cries of surprise. If it were not for Elva's swift action, I would be dead. As a result, I have taken her into my confidence. Where I go, she goes. Let them wonder what it is exactly Elva can do.
This is indeed distressing news, exclaimed the king. Have you caught the blackguard responsible? Seeing the eager expressions of his advisers, Nasuada hesitated.
It would be best to wait until I can give you an account in private, sire.
Orin appeared put out by her response, but he did not pursue the issue. Very well, but sit, sit. We have just received the most troubling report.
After Nasuada took her place opposite him, Elva lurking behind her, he continued,
It seems that our spies in Gilead have been deceived as to the status of Galbatorix's army.
How so?
They believe the army to be in Gilead, whereas we have here a missive from one of our men in Urubane who says that he witnessed a great host march south past the capital a week and a half ago. It was night, so he could not be sure of their numbers, but he was certain that the host was far larger than the 16,000 that form the core of Galbatorix's troops. There may have been as many as 100,000 soldiers or more.
100,000?
A cold pit of fear settled in Nasuada's stomach.
Can we trust your source?
His intelligence has always been reliable.
I don't understand, said Nasuada. How could Galbatorix move that many men without our knowing of it before? The supply trains alone would be miles long. It's been obvious the army was mobilizing, but the Empire was nowhere near ready to deploy.
Falbert spoke then, slapping a heavy hand on the table for emphasis.
We were outfoxed. Our spies must have been deceived with magic to think the army was still in their barracks in Gilead.
Nasuada felt the blood drain from her face.
The only person strong enough to sustain an illusion of that size and duration
is Galbatorix himself, completed Orin. That was our conclusion. It means that Galbatorix has finally abandoned his lair in favour of open combat. Even as we speak, the black foe approaches.
Erwin leaned forward.
The question now is how we should respond. We must confront this threat, of course, but in what manner? Where, when, and how? Our own forces aren't prepared for a campaign of this magnitude, while yours, Lady Nasuada, the Varden, are already accustomed to the fierce clamour of war.
What do you mean to imply? That we should die for you?
I but made an observation. Take it how you will.
Then Orin said, Alone we will be crushed against an army so large. We must have allies, and above all else we must have Aragorn, especially if we are to confront Galbatorix. Nasuada, will you send for him?
I would if I could, but until Arya returns I have no way to contact the elves or to summon Aragorn.
In that case, said Orin in a heavy voice, we must hope that she arrives before it is too late. I do not suppose we can expect the elves' assistance in this affair. While a dragon may traverse the leagues between Aberon and Ellesmere with the speed of a falcon, it would be impossible for the elves to marshal themselves and cross the same distance before the Empire reaches us. That leaves only the dwarves. I know that you have been friends with Hrothgar for many years. Will you send him a plea for help on our behalf? The dwarves have always promised they would fight when the time came.
Nasuada nodded.
Duvrangargata has an arrangement with certain dwarf magicians that allows us to transfer messages instantaneously. I will convey our request, and I will ask Hrothgar to send an emissary to Ceres to inform the elves of the situation so that they are forewarned, if nothing else.
Good. We are quite a ways from Farthendur, but if we can delay the Empire for even a week, the dwarves might be able to get here in time.
The discussion that followed was an exceedingly grim one. Various tactics existed for defeating a larger, though not necessarily superior force, but no one at the table could imagine how they might defeat Galbatorix, especially when Aragorn was still so powerless compared to the ancient king. The only ploy that might succeed would be to surround Aragorn with as many magicians, dwarf and human, as possible, and then attempt to force Galbatorix to confront them alone.
The problem with that plan, thought Nasuada, is that Galbatorix overcame far more formidable enemies during his destruction of the riders, and his strength has only grown since.
She was certain that this had occurred to everyone else as well.
If we but had the elf spellweavers to swell our ranks, then victory might be within our reach. Without them, if we cannot overthrow Galbatorix, the only avenue left may be to flee Alagazia across the Sundering Sea and find a new land in which to build a life for ourselves. There we could wait until Galbatorix is no more. Even he cannot endure forever. The only certainty is that eventually all things shall pass.
They moved on then from tactics to logistics, and here the debate became far more acrimonious as the Council of Elders argued with Orin's advisers over the distribution of responsibilities between the Varden and Surda. Who should pay for this or that, provide rations for labourers who worked for both groups, manage the provisions for their respective warriors, and how numerous other related subjects should be dealt with? In the midst of the verbal fray, Orin pulled a scroll from his belt and said to Nasuada, "On the matter of finances, would you be so kind as to explain a rather curious item that was brought to my attention?"
"I'll do my best, sire."
"I hold in my hand a complaint from the Weavers' Guild, which asserts that weavers throughout Surda have lost a good share of their profits because the textile market has been inundated with extraordinarily cheap lace. Lace, they swear, originates with the Varden." A pained look crossed his face. "It seems foolish to even ask, but does their claim have basis in fact? And if so, why would the Varden do such a thing?" Nasuada made no attempt to hide her smile.
"If you remember, sire, when you refused to lend the Varden more gold, you advised me to find another way for us to support ourselves."
"So I did. What of it?" asked Orin, narrowing his eyes.
"Well, it struck me that while lace takes a long time to make by hand, which is why it's so expensive, lace is quite easy to produce using magic, due to the small amount of energy involved. You, of all people, as a natural philosopher, should appreciate that. By selling our lace here and in the Empire, we have been able to fully fund our efforts. The Varden no longer want for food or shelter."
Few things in her life pleased Nasuada so much as Orin's incredulous expression at that instant. The scroll, frozen halfway between his chin and the table, his slightly parted mouth, and the quizzical frown upon his brow, conspired to give him the stunned appearance of a man who had just seen something he did not understand. She savoured the sight.
"Lace?"
he sputtered.
"Yes, sire."
"You can't fight Galbatorix with lace?"
"Why not, sire?"
He struggled for a moment, then growled,
Because it's not respectable, that's why. What bard would compose an epic about our deeds and write about lace?"
"We do not fight in order to have epics written in our praise."
"Then blast epics! How am I supposed to answer the Weavers' Guild? By selling your lace so cheaply, you hurt people's livelihoods and undermine our economy. It won't do. It won't do at all."
Letting her smile become sweet and warm, Nasuada said in her friendliest tone,
"Oh dear, if it's too much of a burden for your treasury, the Varden would be more than willing to offer you a loan, in return for the kindness you've shown us, at a suitable rate of interest, of course."
The Council of Elders managed to maintain their decorum, but behind Nasuada, Elva uttered a quick laugh of amusement. Red Blade, White Blade. The moment the sun appeared over the tree-lined horizon, Aragorn deepened his breathing, willed his heart to quicken, and opened his eyes as he returned to full awareness. He had not been asleep, for he had not slept since his transformation. When he felt weary and lay himself down to rest, he entered a state that was unto a waking dream. There he beheld many wondrous visions, and walked among the grey shades of his memories, yet all the while remained aware of his surroundings.
He watched the sunrise, and thoughts of Arya filled his mind, as they had every hour since the Agaiti Blodron 2 days before. The morning after the celebration, he had gone looking for her in Tildari Hall, intending to try and make amends for his behaviour, only to discover that she had already left for Surda.
"When will I see her again?" he wondered.
In the clear light of day, he had realised just how much the elves and dragons' magic had dulled his wits during the Agaiti Blodron.
"I may have acted a fool, but it wasn't entirely my fault. I was no more responsible for my conduct than if I were drunk."
Still, he had meant every word he said to Arya, even if normally he would not have revealed so much of himself. A rejection cut Aragorn to the quick. Freed of the enchantments that had clouded his mind, he was forced to admit that she was probably right, that the difference between their ages was too great to overcome. It was a difficult thing for him to accept, and once he had, the knowledge only increased his anguish. Aragorn had heard the expression heartbroken before. Until then, he always considered it a fanciful description, not an actual physical symptom. But now he felt a deep ache in his chest, like that of a sore muscle, and each beat of his heart pained him. His only comfort was Saphira. In those 2 days she had never criticised what he had done, nor did she leave his side for more than a few minutes at a time, lending him the support of her companionship. She talked to him a great deal as well, doing her best to draw him out of his shell of silence. To keep himself from brooding over Arya, Aragorn took Oryk's puzzle ring from his nightstand and rolled it between his fingers, marvelling at how keen his senses had become. He could feel every flaw in the twisted metal. As he studied the ring, he perceived a pattern in the arrangement of the gold bands, a pattern that had escaped him before. Trusting his instinct, he manipulated the bands in the sequence suggested by his observation. To his delight, the 8 pieces fit together perfectly, forming a solid whole. He slid the ring onto the 4th finger of his right hand, admiring how the woven bands caught the light.
"You could not do that before,"
observed Saphira from the bowl in the floor where she slept.
"I can see many things that were once hidden to me."
Aragorn went to the wash closet and performed his morning ablutions, including removing the stubble from his cheeks with a spell. Despite the fact that he now closely resembled an elf, he had retained the ability to grow a beard. Oryk was waiting for them when Aragorn and Saphira arrived at the sparring field. His eyes brightened as Aragorn lifted his hand and displayed the completed puzzle ring.
"You solved it, then?"
"It took me longer than I expected," said Aragorn. "But yes. Are you here to practice as well?"
"Nay. I already got in a bit of axe work with an elf who took a rather fiendish delight in cracking me over the head. No, I came to watch you fight."
"You've seen me fight before," pointed out Aragorn.
"Not for a while, I haven't."
"You mean you're curious to see how I've changed?"
Boric shrugged in response. Vanna approached from across the field. He cried,
"Are you ready, Shade Slayer?"
The elf's condescending demeanour had lessened since their last duel before the Agaiti Blodron, but not by much.
"I'm ready."
Aragorn and Vanna squared off against each other in an open area of the field. Emptying his mind, Aragorn grasped and drew Zarok as fast as he could. To his surprise, the sword felt as if it weighed no more than a willow wand. Without the expected resistance, Aragorn's arm snapped straight, tearing the sword from his hand and sending it whirling 20 yards to his right, where it buried itself in the trunk of a pine tree.
"Can you not even hold on to your blade, rider?"
demanded Vanna.
"I apologize, Vanna Voda," gasped Aragorn.
He clutched his elbow, rubbing the bruised joint to lessen the pain.
"I misjudged my strength."
"See that it does not happen again."
Going to the tree, Vanna gripped Zarok's hilt and tried to pull the sword free. The weapon remained motionless. Vanna's eyebrows met as he frowned at the unyielding crimson blade, as if he suspected some form of trickery. Bracing himself, the elf heaved backward, and with a crack of wood, yanked Zarok out of the pine. Aragorn accepted the sword from Vanna and hefted Zarok, troubled by how light it was.
"Something's wrong," he thought.
"Take your place."
This time it was Vanna who initiated the fight. In a single bound, he crossed the distance between them and thrust his blade toward Aragorn's right shoulder. To Aragorn, it seemed as if the elf moved slower than usual, as if Vanna's reflexes had been reduced to the level of a human's. It was easy for Aragorn to deflect Vanna's sword, blue sparks flying from the metal as their blades grated against one another. Vanna landed with an astonished expression. He struck again, and Aragorn evaded the sword by leaning back, like a tree swaying in the wind. In quick succession, Vanna rained a score of heavy blows upon Aragorn, each of which Aragorn dodged or blocked, using Zarok's sheath as often as the sword to foil Vanna's onslaught. Aragorn soon realized that the spectral dragon from the Agaiti Blodron had done more than alter his appearance. It had also granted him the elves' physical abilities. In strength and speed, Aragorn now matched even the most athletic elf. Fired by that knowledge and a desire to test his limits, Aragorn jumped as high as he could. Zarok flashed crimson in the sunlight as he flew skyward, soaring more than 10 feet above the ground before he flipped like an acrobat and came down behind Vanna, facing the direction from which he had started. A fierce laugh erupted from Aragorn. No more was he helpless before elves, shades, and other creatures of magic. No more would he suffer the elves' contempt. No more would he have to rely on Saphira or Arya to rescue him from enemies like Durza. He charged Vanna, and the field rang with a furious din as they strove against each other, raging back and forth upon the trampled grass. The force of their blows created gusts of wind that whipped their hair into tangled disarray. Overhead, the trees shook and dropped their needles. The duel lasted long into the morning, for even with Aragorn's newfound skill, Vanna was still a formidable opponent. But in the end, Aragorn would not be denied. Playing Zarok in a circle, he darted past Vanna's guard and struck him upon the upper arm, breaking the bone. Vanna dropped his blade, his face turning white with shock.
"How swift is your sword?" he said, and Aragorn recognized the famous line from the Lay of Umhodan.
"By the gods!" exclaimed Oric. "That was the best swordsmanship I've ever seen, and I was there when you fought Arya in Fardendur."
Then Vanna did what Aragorn had never expected. The elf twisted his uninjured hand in a gesture of fealty, placed it upon his sternum, and bowed.
"I beg your pardon for my earlier behaviour, Aragorn Elder. I thought that you had consigned my race to the void, and out of my fear, I acted most shamefully. However, it seems that your race no longer endangers our cause." In a grudging voice, he added, "You are now worthy of the title Rider."
Aragorn bowed in return.
"You honour me. I am sorry that I injured you so badly. Will you allow me to heal your arm?"
"No. I shall let nature tend to it at her own pace, as a memento that I once crossed blades with Aragorn Shadeslayer. You needn't fear that it will disrupt our sparring tomorrow. I am equally good with my left hand."
They both bowed again, and then Vanna departed. Oric slapped a hand on his thigh and said,
"Now we have a chance at victory, a real chance. I can feel it in my bones. Bones like stone, they say. Ah, this'll please Hrothgar and Nasuada to no end."
Aragorn kept his peace and concentrated on removing the block from Zarok's edges. But he said to Saphira, "If brawn were all that was required to depose Galbatorix, the elves would have done it long ago." Still, he could not help being pleased by his heightened prowess, as well as by his long-awaited reprieve from the torment of his back. Without the constant bursts of pain, it was as if a haze had been lifted from his mind, allowing him to think clearly once again. A few minutes remained before they were supposed to meet with Oromis and Gleda, so Aragorn took his bow and quiver from where they hung on Saphira's back and walked to the range where elves practiced archery. Since the elves' bows were much more powerful than his, their padded targets were both too small and too far away for him. He had to shoot from halfway down the range. Taking his place, Aragorn knocked an arrow and slowly pulled back the string, delighted by how easy it had become. He aimed, released the arrow, and held his position, waiting to see if he would hit his mark. Like a maddened hornet, the dart buzzed toward the target and buried itself in the center. He grinned. Again and again he fired at the target, his speed increasing with his confidence until he loosed 30 arrows in a minute. At the 31st arrow, he pulled on the string slightly harder than he had ever done or was capable of doing before. With an explosive report, the U-bow broke in half underneath his left hand, scratching his fingers and discharging a burst of splinters from the back of the bow. His hand went numb from the jolt.